Why do a sociological book on emerging church?
Well, I think I'm going to blame my co-author, Gerard O'Marty, actually. it's probably just easiest to explain the story of how the book came to be. 4 years ago, Pete Rollins, who some of you may know, organized a conference here in Belfast. And it was actually held where I work, up at the Irish School of Ecumenics. We hosted the event. And, you know, I can't even remember what the conference was called, but quite a few people from the United States and from Europe came to it. And one of them was a sociologist from Davidson College in North Carolina, Gerard O'Marty. And while he was there, I sort of became, I suppose, the interpreter of Pete Rollins for him, right? He spent a lot of time questioning me about, you know, what does Pete really mean by this? And I don't know if I explained with sufficient clarity or not, but it was enough, I suppose it stimulated enough interest in Gerardo that one evening we were driving down, we were taking him to hear some, Sean Donnelly play Irish traditional music in Newcastle, and he just turned to me and said, we should write a book about the emerging church, and I was like, okay. So that's really how it got started from that event. And Gerardo, I suppose, he had a grant from the Pew Foundation in the United States, and he had been to different parts of America sort of doing some preliminary research on the emerging church in the U.S. So he had that background, and he was quite interested in how stuff Pete Rollins was doing might or might not fit within that emerging picture.
Well, that... Sorry.
Oh, I'm talking too fast.
Now, you see, my mother tells me that, but it's Gladys's husband tells her that, so... Somebody said to me the other night, and they're in the room, I love the way you speak fast because it keeps my attention. So it's hard to know which one to please.
You all understood the first part of that, though, hopefully, yes.
Tell me, Gladys, you touched on two things there. Pete Rollins, obviously Belfast icon, and we have some icon people in the house tonight. And on Facebook today, one of them was telling me, icon is not emerging church. And then you said, does Pete Rollins fit into that? What is emerging church? Which obviously the book's mainly trying to say, and that's not an easy answer. And Pete and icon, if I was asking a question, it would be, why would a professor from North Carolina have such an interest in something here that's not exactly... There might be people in the room that have never actually heard of icon, and across the world it's quite renowned. Can you explain some of those two phenomena? What is emerging church? What is Pete Rollins, if he is linked with icon, he was a founder of that, and how do those link?
Okay, so what is the emerging church, right? This is the question where your heart sinks when people want like a two-sentence answer, and you know it's nearly impossible to give that when you're trying to define the emerging church. Sometimes I give a PowerPoint about this and I just have a big blank screen for the definition page. But usually the way I try to go about defining it is to first describe a few examples of it and then try to I suppose, draw some threads from the examples. So to give examples, for lack of a better place to start, quite often things that are associated with the emerging church would be like a pub church, okay? So groups that meet in pubs and talk about God over a pint, this type of thing. Gerardo and I also consider the new monastic movement part of the broader emerging church movement. So some of you may have heard of this, like Shane Claiborne with The Simple Way in Philadelphia. We would see him as one of the new monastics. And these would be, you know, groups of people who commit to living intentionally, often in a deprived urban area. So I think he calls it, you know, the abandoned places of the empire. So they'd live kind of communally, either in one house or in houses close to one another, and sort of try to live out a vocation this way. We see that as part of the emerging church. Also kind of online networks, particular blogs, online communities that are discussing a lot of the issues that are associated with the emerging church. This would be another example. Some of the conferences particularly that go on in the United States, which provide, I suppose, an alternative outlet for people to discuss issues that they think are off limits in their own churches. And another key thing, I suppose, when you're describing the emerging church is to say that we're pretty sure empirically that it has emerged from evangelical Protestantism. So In many ways, the congregations, the groups and communities that you can identify with the emerging church are somehow critiquing evangelicalism. And they're critiquing them both by making, you know, direct verbal critiques of certain ideas, doctrines, and beliefs, but also critiquing them through the way they try to live out their faith, so the embodied practices of Christianity, to put it that way. So I can talk a bit more about that later, because I don't want to spend too much time describing before I get on to a definition. So in the book, when we do get around to giving a definition after we have gone through some of these examples, we came up with this idea of calling emerging Christians, or saying that people in the emerging church movement have a religious orientation. Now, in the sociology of religion, which is the field I work in, people often talk about religious identity. And to us, identity seemed too rigid of a word, right? People in the emerging church movement don't want to be put into boxes. So we came up with using this idea of orientation to try to connotate, you know, a certain way of looking at the world. And I'll read the orientation definition that we use in the book. And we say that emerging Christianity is a distinct religious orientation that encourages individual autonomy, okay, at the same time as deep commitments to relationships with others. So trying to balance individualism with community, I suppose. This religious orientation includes common beliefs about truth, doubt, and the nature of God. And again, later on, I can be more specific about what some of those beliefs are. And even the idea of saying there are common beliefs within emerging Christianity is probably a bit controversial, but, you know, empirically, we think we found enough so that we could make that claim. And practices. And the practices would include innovations in preaching, worship, the way Eucharist is done, and leadership, and so forth. And we think that key, I suppose, for the kind of modern or postmodern world that we're living now, this sort of religious orientation appeals to people who might say they're spiritual, but not institutionally religious. So another thing that's really key and important about the emerging church is that it's anti-institutional. In fact, among some groups in the emerging church, there's a real effort not to have institutions at all. Okay, so the last time Pete was over, we heard him talking about pop-up churches, right? You know, so commit to having a community of people together for a year that after a year would agree to part, to stop having that community and so forth. So a sense to try to keep things, I suppose, temporary, anti-institutional. That's another key aspect of emerging Christianity. Now, I suppose that was rather long-winded, and I hope it made sense in some way, shape, or form. I haven't even answered the question about Pete now, have I?
You touched on Pete at the end there, and I mean, I was sharing how I was hijacked on a Canadian radio show where this guy was interviewing me, and he said to me, "And do you know Pete Rollins?" And I said, "Yeah, I know Pete." And he said, "You would like to take him out the back and give him a good kicking, wouldn't you?" And I'm live on Canadian radio, and I'm thinking, I really wouldn't. And I said, "Well, no, I'm a good friend of Pete's, and I respect his intellect too much to do that." And then he said, "Pete, what do you think of that?" And Pete was on the other line. And one of the questions I'd said I would like to ask Pete is, why is there so much deconstruction, and what is he trying to build? Now, your book is called The Deconstructed Church. So is it all about deconstruction, or what are they building?
Right. Yes, okay. How to come at that question. The Deconstructed Church, I suppose that title is getting at a couple of things. Now, on the one hand, Pete especially, but also some of the main figures in the United States, such as Brian McLaren and Rob Bell and so on, they very much see this type of Christianity as suited to postmodernity. And, of course, one of the key aspects of postmodernity is deconstruction. And kind of playing with ideas such, is there an objective truth, and these sorts of things. And so it's kind of referring to that philosophical debate, that conversation that takes place in the emerging church. But I suppose for us, and the key, well, for me, I don't know, I probably can't speak exactly for Gerardo in this, but the key aspect of the title that I focus in on is the deconstruction being this anti-institutional aspect of the emerging church. Because some of the more radical within the movement, literally, if you take them at what they're saying at face value, don't really I suppose, want to see Christianity continue in its current modern phase of sort of denominations, strong institutions with, you know, a form of hierarchical leadership from above, and we'd be striving almost towards this religionless Christianity. So that's the term that Pete would use a lot, you know, a Christianity without religion, a Christianity without institutions. In the United States, some groups have done things like taken deliberate steps to keep their communities from becoming too institutionalized. And one of the things they do is deliberately choose not to have ordained clergy, or if they do have an ordained clergy person, would only be part-time, and that person would also have, you know, a job that they work in the secular world as well. Other things communities might do to avoid institutionalizing would be to, I suppose, devolve authority and control so that you mightn't even know what's going on in all sections of your community. You know, go take away the church announcement bulletin, I suppose, and just let people get on and do things themselves. So for me, the deconstructed bit is this anti-institutional bit. And when you ask what then maybe, what are these people trying to build? I think what they're trying to build is a community where people take, I suppose, responsibility for their own spiritual quests, and they take responsibility for each other as well without authority figures or church institutions telling them they should do this, right? So, and to give an example of how this was articulated, Christian Century did an interview with Pete a few years ago, and he, you know, he told a story about how if something bad happens to you, you know, ICON isn't the community that calls you up. Someone's not going to call you up on behalf of ICON to comfort you. But if you have a friend in ICON, that is the person who's going to call you up. It's each person, rather than the institution, I suppose, taking responsibility for themselves and for others. So I suppose what they're trying to build is a Christianity without institutions, where people are more responsible.
I'm going to step down and listen to you, but it seems to me, from my position, there's a lot for us to think about in emerging church, and we haven't done a lot of thinking about it, because they're critiquing not only the church but the society that we live in, and that we as institutional churches may need to be listening very carefully, but we're obviously going to want to listen to the things that we need to hear, and maybe we need to dismiss the things we don't need to hear, and those are the questions. So tonight is, what can Northern Ireland evangelicalism learn from emerging church? I hand it to you and see if you can help us through that one.
Right. So that's a very wide open question, I suppose. Well, it might, to answer that question, it might be helpful to start with some of the particular critiques of evangelicalism itself. And I think there are a couple categories of critique. So there's social critique, and there's the critique of ideas, and there's a critique of practices. So social or political critique, as many of you may know, the emerging church is bigger and more significant in the United States. This is the place where it is the most popular and the most prominent, and you have the most key figures associated with it. And a key part of their critique is the way that American evangelicalism has been politicized and aligned with the religious right. And they would see kind of the social and political program of the Republican Party, which has been backed by evangelicals, as, well, I suppose, contrary to the gospel, would be the blunt way of putting it. And I think in Northern Ireland as well, back when I was doing interviews for my PhD ages ago, I talked to some people who were involved with ICON at that time. And I think part of their disillusionment with Northern Irish evangelicalism had been the way that evangelical churches had uncritically aligned themselves with political unionism, in some cases Paisleyism, and so on and so forth. And also a critique of Northern Irish evangelical churches as very moralistic, right? So things, you know, like focusing on sexual sin rather than social justice, that type of thing. So there's a social political critique, which means that, you know, sometimes emerging Christians are kind of accused of being liberal evangelicals or something like that, which we don't think they really are. We think they're something distinct from that. In terms of particular ideas that the emerging church critiques, I think there are some key ones. And I said you know, earlier that it's quite hard to pick out ideas that have a consensus or people in the emerging church agree on, because one of the ways they describe their movement is as a conversation. And actually this thing of describing your movement as a conversation is another way to be anti-institutional, because if the goal is to always be in conversation, you obviously can't really develop doctrines or statements of faith or this sort of thing, because it then makes it easier for you to become institutionalized. And emerging Christians are very aware that they don't want to become institutionalized, so they want to keep this conversation going. But at the same time, I think there are kind of key ideas that you can see that most people within the movement would share. And probably one of the most significant ones is this about what the atonement means. So I think most emerging Christians would agree that the substitutionary theory of the atonement is just wrong, you know. So probably the most famous soundbite of saying this was, you know, was it Steve Chalk who said that the substitutionary theory of the atonement is cosmic child abuse, right? So they just think that that's bad theology, and that might be, you know, controversial for people within Northern Ireland, within evangelicalism, but that I think is one of their critiques. And their preferred views, I suppose, of what Jesus' death and resurrection on the cross means I suppose, at one hand, some would take a Girardian view, you know, of scapegoating, that type of view of what the cross means, and others would take, I suppose, a view that Christ's death on the cross is an identification with our suffering. It's not, I suppose, the ransom, but it's an identification, and it's an almost, you know, it's a God who becomes powerless and dies and suffers, but it's not, I suppose, the same sort of triumphant picture you might get in some expositions of the substitutionary theory of the atonement. A second key belief would be around truth, and I mentioned earlier with postmodernism, you know, bringing in to question the idea that there is absolute objective truth. And a lot of emerging Christians, I think, would associate that with the Enlightenment and the scientific method and all these things, and would have been, I suppose, maybe burned in their youth, if that's a way of putting it, by people who read the Bible as if it was a science textbook or something like this. So I think a lot of it comes out of that. But truth, then, you know, it's not something objective. Rather, it's something that is embodied, right? So truth embodied is the way Christ lived his life on earth. I suppose in one of my interviews, someone said to me once, you know, truth is if you are living as a Methodist, as a Presbyterian or whatever, and that makes you a better person and other people are drawn to Christ, you know, or something like this, this idea of embodied truth rather than truth that you can, you know, read in a book. Sometimes the emphasis on narrative and story brings that out. Another key thing is the emphasis on doubt. Okay, and again, within evangelicalism, there's often been an emphasis that any sort of doubt is wrong, right? It's a sign that you don't have faith, or that your faith is wanting, or that you are sinning, or something like this. And doubt is something to be resisted, is something that's come to you from Satan, or something like this. So emerging Christians would generally take a view that this is the wrong way to interpret doubt. For them, doubt is something to be welcomed. Doubt and faith are two sides of the one coin. And doubt is actually a very helpful place for you to be. And in one way that doubt is helpful is that it shows that you're alive, right? That you're questioning, that your faith is living, that, you know, you're thinking about being a Christian and what it means to live well in the world, these types of things. But some, I think, would even go further than that when thinking about doubt. And I think Pete probably does this, especially in his later books, so that doubt is almost the normal state to be in when you're a Christian, as it were. And Pete would write stuff about, you know, how Christ on the cross experiences doubt. He experiences the absence of God. He experiences the abandonment of God. And that if you're able to get to a place where you can live as if God does not exist and still live like a Christian, that kind of is a place to be, and doubt facilitates you being able to do that. So I'll stop there because I've been talking a lot and I need a break, but hopefully that made sense. And if there's anything unclear, feel free to ask.